From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Wade Goodwin. This episode, in the last 2 weeks, tornadoes in Oklahoma have killed nearly three dozen people. If you're in the direct path of an EF5 tornado, should you run or should you hide?
If it's coming east and you can go north, you're going to be fine. Just get out of the way.
Also, across the nation, school suspensions have become a runaway train. Millions of students are instructed to go away.
That kind of practice and policy has been especially applied to poor kids and especially black kids.
One LA school district decided enough is enough. It's no longer suspending students routinely. And then, is bike sharing the next trend in stress-free urban living?
It's magical. You have the breeze in your hair.
Plus, writer Cherie Booker on the 9 years she spent working in an inner-city Baltimore funeral home, and Hootie, also known as Darius Rucker, releases his third solo country album, and he says it's by far his best.
Turn it up, put the windows down to get your friends in the car and drive and just sing along.
That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. We start our program today with news out of Oklahoma, where a series of tornadoes accompanied by violent rainstorms have left at least nine dead. This comes less than 2 weeks after another round of tornadoes devastated the state. Kurt Gwartney is the news director at NPR's member station KGOU. He joins us from Norman, Oklahoma. Welcome, Kurt.
Thank you, Wade.
Kurt, how much notice did Oklahoma City have before the tornado hit?
A tornado watch for central Oklahoma was first issued at 3:30 Friday afternoon, and then the first tornado warning came nearly 2 hours later at 5:37 p.m. But the National Weather Service had really started raising awareness for severe weather this week at the end of last. Forecasters were saying the storms would start Wednesday and continue into Friday. And each day the weather was more severe, and by Friday morning we were expecting significant tornadoes. And on Friday, the Oklahoma Department of Transportation even put specific warnings on its electronic road signs along the major interstates to alert drivers to the danger.
There were a lot of people on the road at the time of the storm. How come?
Well, I talked to Trooper Betsy Randolph with the Oklahoma Highway Patrol, and she told me there were several ingredients that led to so many people being on I-40, that's Interstate 40, at the time of the tornado. First of all, it was rush hour, and even though a lot of employers let their workers go home early, there were still a lot of cars on the road. And the second, I-40 is a major traffic pipeline, not only for Oklahoma City, but for the nation. It also intersects another major roadway, I-35. And there are just lots of people traveling through who didn't understand the severity of the storm and the risk they were taking. But she also said there were people who left their homes to get to what they believe would be a safer place.
Kurt, we heard an awful story last night about a mother and child killed on I-40 during the tornado. Is there any more information?
Well, the mother and child who died in the storm were tossed from their vehicle while it was lifted into the air by the tornado. Trooper Randolph told me that another trooper actually watched as they fell to the ground. She didn't have any details on why they were on the road or even where they were headed, but she did say the woman's husband and two other children actually survived the incident, and she didn't know if they were still in the vehicle after it was in the air or if they fell out.
There's been a lot of flooding.
There has been. The storm dumped more than 7 inches of rain in the Oklahoma City metro in just a few hours. Most of that occurred in places that we know have problems with water. There were several rescues through the night, and most of those happened because people actually drove into the water. One mobile home park had to be evacuated this morning due to flooding, and now just recently the Oklahoma County Sheriff's Office is reporting that a man missing since early this morning has actually been found dead in a creek. His vehicle was found washed off the road in the eastern part of Oklahoma County.
KGOU's Kurt Gwartney, thanks and be safe.
Thank you.
The tornadoes yesterday were preceded nearly 2 weeks before by an EF5 tornado, which destroyed a large section of Moore just south of Oklahoma City. And both episodes raised two sides of one question. That's our cover story today. When caught in a tornado's path, should you run or hide? At 4 p.m. on Monday, May 20th, I got a call in Dallas from NPR's senior national editor in Washington, D.C. He told me to turn on the TV.
And you see, it's a violent tornado. This is a tornado emergency. My God, get below ground if at all possible.
A small suburb of Oklahoma City had just been hit by a tornado, and it looked bad, real bad.
And so Moore's in the bullseye. So I'm going to give, as we look at the shots there, we can see it.
I was instructed to get my stuff together and go north as quickly as I could. When I got to Moore, Oklahoma, the swath the tornado had cut through town was awe-inspiring and sickening. A little after midnight, I began writing the piece for Morning Edition from Oklahoma. Toward the end of the story, a young woman named Molly Edwards, covered in pink insulation dust, stands on the rubble of her home with her family. Just before the tornado slammed into her neighborhood, she and her husband had rushed to pick up their children from Plaza Towers Elementary School. That's the school where 7 third graders died after suffocating under fallen debris.
We thought it might be safer for them to be there than to be here because we didn't have a shelter, but we just didn't want to chance it, so we went and picked them up and just decided we would get in the car and head away from it, and that's probably what saved us, because if we would have all been in here, somebody would have ended up hurt.
I didn't completely understand at the time that I was hearing the tip of an iceberg, but as the day wore on, I was surprised that the death toll wasn't higher than 24 people. After all, hundreds of homes had been completely wiped off their foundations. So when I interviewed Moore City Manager Steve Eady later that day, I expressed my mystification, and Eady's answer was an eye-opener.
Now, this kind of a situation, the larger, this massive tornado, many people, and why there's not very many casualties compared to the amount of destruction, is that people leave. I promise you, thousands of people left Moore, Oklahoma, on that afternoon.
This runs counter to the current counsel by FEMA and other authorities, which is to shelter in place in an interior room with no windows until the tornado has passed. But when it comes to major tornadoes, this advice is being increasingly ignored by Oklahomans. Chief 9 meteorologist Gary England is one of the country's leading experts on tornadoes. For the last 40 years, he's been tracking tornadoes at KWTV in Oklahoma City, and you heard some of his reporting at the top of this story.
If you want to live, if you want to live through a major tornado and you have time, 10, 15 minutes, you know where the tornado is, what direction it's going, and you know what direction to go, you would be foolish not to evacuate the premises, get in the vehicle, and leave the area.
And England was actually able to help them do that. Through his station's helicopter camera, England could see where drivers were stuck in traffic, and he tried to lead them away from the tornado.
It's moving towards southwest 149th in Portland, and it's moving towards southwest 160th. And so we were given street directions, where to go, and all that type of thing, because a lot of people were in their cars. And let me tell you, a few of them just made it by the hair on their chinny chin chin.
But yesterday afternoon's tornadoes in Oklahoma were a lesson in what can happen if too many try to flee at once. As we just heard, combined with the Friday afternoon rush hour, traffic on the interstates came to a halt. Cars were lifted and flipped upside down by the tornadoes. 18-wheelers were mauled, and a mother and child died after being sucked out of their car as it was lifted into the sky. It was bad, but it could have been even worse had the tornadoes not dissipated. Yesterday, just hours before those tornadoes slammed into the Oklahoma City area, we spoke with Rick Smith of the National Weather Service. Smith is the warning coordination meteorologist in Norman, Oklahoma, and he agreed that fleeing a massive tornado could be a good strategy if your escape path was wide open.
To me, if I lived in a rural area in western Oklahoma where the population was 100, it would be a very easy decision. If there's a tornado coming and I've got just a few minutes and I know that I can drive 5 minutes south and park and wait for it to pass, I'd probably do that. If you're in Oklahoma City, 5 minutes isn't enough. 20 minutes may not be enough. 30 minutes, 45 minutes, because of everybody else is going to do the same thing.
And this afternoon, we talked to Rick Smith again.
That's eerie to listen to that, because of that is precisely what happened yesterday.
Do you think people were trying to flee the tornado when they got trapped on the highway?
I really don't know. We've been chatting on social media all night and all morning today and just trying to wrap our brains around this. I mean, when you and I talked yesterday, I came back to the office here and our discussion really sparked something in us here in the office to say, hey, this is going to be an issue today. It's exactly what we described, Friday afternoon rush hour, people wanting to get out of the way of the storm. So we set about putting special information out, information describing the recommended tornado safety precautions, and for people that if you decide later today that you think you need to flee, here are the guidelines. So I think it's a combination of being so close to the Moore tornado. There were evidently some success stories with the Moore tornado, but that was a very different situation. That was at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a Monday, not complicated by flash flooding and other storms in the area. All this happening at afternoon rush hour was just a recipe for disaster.
In Moore, 24 people died, although they hunkered down inside as best they could. Yesterday evening, we had people die in their vehicles as they tried to flee or simply tried to get home from work. I think this points to the fact that there's no single strategy that will save you, no matter what the circumstances.
And that's what's so complicated and frustrating for those of us whose job it is to try to save people's lives when these storms are in the area. What do we do? There is no universal one-size-fits-all guidance or safety rules for tornadoes. I don't think I've ever had a more helpless feeling as a meteorologist watching the TV coverage than seeing a helicopter shot of a line of headlights stranded, stopped dead still on the interstate as motorists tried to drive south out of Oklahoma City, and knowing that this horrendous beast of a storm was bearing down on them. I don't know the answers. There are no easy answers, but this is something that needs to be addressed, not by meteorologists necessarily, but by a multidisciplinary group of people who understand or attempt to understand human behavior and messaging and all kinds of things. It's a very complex issue.
Rick Smith is the Warning Coordination Meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Norman, Oklahoma. Rick, it's just the beginning of the tornado season. Thank you and good luck.
Thank you.
In Moore, people who hunkered down as best they could died anyway, including a mother and infant who'd taken shelter in a 7-Eleven's metal freezer box. Yesterday, Oklahomans got in their cars and trucks to flee, but some of them died at the wheel, including a mother and an infant. Without a storm shelter, Oklahoma can be a dangerous place. Back in the 1960s and 70s, when I was going to school, getting suspended was a big deal. It certainly didn't happen very often. But that's not true anymore. Last year, for example, in the state of California, students got suspended more than 700,000 times. One school district decided it was getting ridiculous. A couple of weeks ago, the board for the LA Unified School District passed a new resolution. They banned the use of suspensions to punish students for what's called willful defiance.
Things like bringing a cell phone to school, or public display of affection, or truancy, or repeatedly being tardy.
Offenses like these accounted for nearly half of all student suspensions issued in California last year. But there's mounting research that says out-of-school suspensions put students on the fast track to falling behind, dropping out, and jail. And some groups are suspended more than others. That's today's cover story, race, class, and school suspensions. 4 years ago at John Muir Middle School in South Central L.A., now 16-year-old Damian Valentine was getting into trouble.
I was talking a little bit to another student, you know, the seventh grade, doing work, talked to another student, and she asked me to move my seat.
He did, but Valentine and his classmates kept talking, and his teacher grew more frustrated and wanted Valentine to move again. This time, Damian refused.
I told her I don't deserve to move my seat. Somebody else should move their seat because I already moved mine. So was it just my day to get picked on today, or what was it?
Valentine and his teacher exchanged a few more words before she sent him to the dean's office, and the dean agreed Damian had been willfully defiant.
He said the best thing for me would probably to take a day off of school.
That was Damian Valentine's first out-of-school suspension. But after that, the suspensions kept coming. In eighth grade, Valentine had a few confrontations. Not fights, he says, just some heated words between students, but he got suspended again. Then his freshman year of high school, he was suspended from campus for 3 weeks, accused of helping to start a gang. Valentine believes teachers and principals have an unspoken way of seeing boys and girls of color.
African Americans always come into class late. They're always going to be disruptive, and they're just going to bring everybody else down. So as soon as you go inside the class and get in trouble, they say they already expected it. They already expected for this African-American male to act like that.
There was certainly a lot of suspending going on in Damien's school back then. According to the U.S. Department of Education, in the 2008 school year, students at John Muir were suspended 325 times. And although black students made up just 23% of the student body, they got half the total suspensions. And that's a pattern that extends beyond L.A.
It's more likely your perception of a student's behavior is negative if they're a black student or a student with disabilities.
Daniel Lozen is an expert on out-of-school suspensions. In April, he published Out of School and Off Track, which looked at the numbers and found astonishing suspension rates for certain demographics.
One out of every four black students enrolled in our middle schools and high schools was suspended at least one time. Kids with disabilities, about one in every five. Students who are English learners, especially males, in elementary school, only about 2% of those students are suspended out of school. But in middle school, it rises up to 16%.
I'm looking at a chart here, and in 73, black, Latino, whites, American Indians, and Asians are all fairly bunched close together, although blacks are on top, followed by Latino. And then by the time we reach 2010, blacks have shot up much higher than everybody else. What's going on here?
As we've gotten to this sort of zero-tolerance mentality, that kind of policy has been especially applied to poor kids and especially black kids and also kids with disabilities. It's really important to note that the risk of dropping out doubles for being suspended even one time. The dropout rate for kids who weren't suspended was 16%. Getting suspended out of school even one time, it goes up to 32%. Two or more times, it's at 49%.
What happens to a student when he's given a suspension?
Well, all the research says that it contributes to their disengagement from school. So you can imagine that for poor students, students from single-parent households or kids who are homeless, they're much more likely to wind up on the streets unsupervised. So there's no guarantee of any adult supervision, and that is one of the reasons that they're much more likely to join gangs and to become involved in the juvenile justice system.
When a student is suspended, is he taking the first step on his way to prison?
Unfortunately, that is the case. So in addition to increased risk of dropping out, getting suspended out of school even one time is associated with doubling or tripling the risk for juvenile justice involvement. And that brings up another really important issue. The costs of suspending students are really sky high, but they're hidden costs.
Daniel Lozen of UCLA's Civil Rights Project. But not all teachers are on board.
If I see the classroom environment is suffering, that the students are getting scared, I will remove the problem student because my other students have rights too.
Martha Infante teaches at Los Angeles Academy Middle School, just across the freeway from John Muir. Infante has taught for 16 years. She believes her ability to suspend disruptive students is an important tool to maintain control of her classroom. She doesn't want disruptive students to drop out or become criminals, but she's not going to sacrifice the right of her other students to learn either.
What happens is that I have to take time away from instruction to explain to those students that they have to follow my instructions. The more time you spend on discipline issues, it affects the classroom environment.
Infante says she doesn't hand out suspensions willy-nilly, far from it.
You offer counseling, you get services, whatever services are available.
The problem is, in this era of budget cuts, counselors and psychiatric social workers are in short supply. Infante says she rarely issues suspensions, but that just the threat of suspension is often effective.
What they do respond to is being separated from their friends, being removed from the classroom. That is something they don't want.
Infante says the school board's actions are confusing and troubling. There's been no memo outlining precisely what teachers can and can't do, but the board has released next year's budget, and there's no money for more support services, so no suspensions and no support for other strategies. But Principal Jose Huerta has found a third way.
It's simple. It doesn't cost money. It's just connecting with kids and having a strong instructional program.
At Garfield High, there are no suspensions, even though there's no more money for counselors or social workers. The year before Jose Huerta took over as principal at Garfield, there were 683 suspensions. Huerta says suspending students had become a reflex to poor behavior. But when he took over in 2010, Jose Huerta said no more, and the results have been dramatic. Just two suspensions total in the last 3 years.
I didn't come into Garfield saying, okay, my mission in life is to lower suspensions. It wasn't. It was to enhance and improve the instruction. And because we did, we were successful with a great teacher group, a great administrative staff, great parents. We have over 80 parents on a daily basis volunteering their time here at Garfield. And the students listening to us, telling them, preaching them, lecturing them, they finally got it. We're in the middle of East Los Angeles, inner city school, impoverished area. You'll never see graffiti on my campus. You'll rarely see any kind of physical fight here. People are looking at, whoa, suspensions. Wow, what did you do? Look at that. And I try to turn it around and say, it wasn't our focus, folks. You want to make it right, you got to connect with kids. You need to connect.
So let's say that you have an 11th grader who's unruly in class, he's talking back to the teacher, he's creating a situation in which it's impossible to teach. What do you do with that student?
I'll tell you what, that is very rare, but it's hypothetically speaking, because we address those issues. It happens, they're teenagers. Teenagers will make mistakes, bad choices. What happens? Immediately, the teacher talks to him, already know, has a relationship with him, first of all, because he knows the kid, calls the counselor, and we find out what the real deal is. Many kids, when they act out the way you describe, sir, they are just calling out for help. There's something that happened. We have a counseling team. We have a student support team, and we discuss it. What's going on? 90% of the time, sir, we find out that something happened the night before. Either dad left the house, doesn't want to live at the home anymore, or there was somebody passed away, maybe somebody dear to them. It could have been somebody was deported. We have families that get their mom or dad got picked up, and all of a sudden they're out here by themselves. They were born here, so they're staying here. That's a rare instance, but it's happened. But these are teenagers. They're not going to go and cry to anybody. They're a tough neighborhood. So when that kid acts out, we get in his face immediately, sir. We get to the problem, and if it's bigger than us, we have a lot of community resources that help us, and we resolve it. And you know what? These kids respond well. Their needs were met.
Since there's no money for additional professionals, Huerta has substituted parents and nonprofit community groups. He believes everyone needs to be held accountable, students, parents, teachers, and the local community. Across town in South Central L.A., Damian Valentine, you remember, the student who was suspended after refusing to change seats, is now about to finish his sophomore year of high school. That 3-week suspension for alleged gang activities made him believe he didn't have a future at his school, so he took action.
After I got suspended for those 3 weeks, I was like, oh, I can't keep getting suspended. After I transferred to the next school, I said, all right, this is a new start.
And it has been a new start for Valentine. At Manual Arts High, he's been able to stay out of trouble. And at the L.A. Unified School Board meeting, where the decision to curtail suspensions was made, Valentine testified about how suspensions almost pushed him out of the school system altogether. He's proud he was part of the process of changing the school district's suspension policy. It's a good time to be a cyclist in America. New York kicked off a new bike-sharing program this week, with Chicago and San Francisco close behind. We thought we should hear from some bikers themselves, so we camped out at one of Washington's Capital Bike Share stations as people check bikes in and out.
Want to get in there?
Easy as that.
My name is Michael Margolis. I'm a law student at George Washington. Parking is so difficult, and Capital Bike Share has allowed me just to go anywhere on the fly. I'm 10 minutes away from everywhere, law school, going shopping.
Going home after the bars at night, going to work. Katrina Gordon, it's magical, you have the breeze in your hair.
My name is Marlene, I think you would say, Marlene Küster. We are from Germany and just visiting Washington. we walked around yesterday by foot and we saw many people riding a bike, and so that gave us the trust to feel like we could do the same.
It's gotten better and you'll be like, oh my god, this bike lane existed, I had no idea it's here. And then other times you're like, there's no way, it's like so fragmented. And my name is Lauren Weinstein.
Ross Mohan, I work in the computer industry. Despite the traffic getting worse, the drivers seem to be more conscious of different types of traffic on the road, so it's turning up. And now I engage the warp drive. You have a good day.
Washington has become a much easier place to bike recently. The city was named the fourth most bike-friendly city in America by Bicycling Magazine last year. Gabe Klein, now with the City of Chicago, was a big part of that change. He was the director of the Department of Transportation in D.C. and oversaw a big increase in bike lanes. Klein was inspired by Montreal's successful bike share and in 2010 helped launch Capital Bike Share. Klein says they forecasted 500,000 rides that first year and ended up with 1 million. Klein described how it all works.
Each location where the bikes live is what we would call a node, somewhere between 6 and, 30 bikes. We try to push people to use it for almost like a taxi, for transit-type trips, not to keep it all day.
Well, I lived in New York for 7 years, and I'm here in Washington, D.C., and I see cyclists on the road, but they look like daredevils to me. Who rides bikes in a place filled with automobiles?
When it doesn't feel as safe, the people that are riding are what we call the strong and the fearless, and they make up about 7%. What we have found is that 60% of the population would like to ride. The problem is they don't feel safe. And those are the people that we're appealing to with the infrastructure that we're putting in here in Chicago or that you've seen in Washington, D.C., protected bike facilities that separate people from cars, and with the bike sharing program.
How much pushback do you get from people who are nothing but annoyed when they see bikers sharing their road?
40% of trips in urban areas are 2 miles or less, but 90% of those trips are taken in a car. So you can do the math. If we can move 20-30% of those people to walking or biking, that frees up a lot of capacity for people to drive that need to.
There's a criticism that, the only ones who use this are hipsters and gentrifiers, and that this is money, I won't say wasted, but focused on this demographic. What do you say to that criticism?
We're very concerned with the equity issue, and that's one of the reasons that we're building protected facilities throughout the city, not just in certain neighborhoods. There's a study that came out by the League of American Cyclists and the Sierra Club that shows that there's been a 100% growth in the percent of trips by bike from 2001 to 2009 by African Americans, 50% in Hispanic, and only 22% in whites.
But the nodes really aren't in black communities here in D.C. They're more in the hipster enclaves.
Well, no, we were very careful with that. Let's be honest, the more density, the busier those stations will be. But we did launch stations across the river in Southeast. I believe we started with 8 or 10 stations. They weren't as busy. But it's important to market the service to everybody. And part of marketing the service in the African-American community was actually to have the service in the community. Because, again, everybody needs transportation.
Is there a density issue? Do you have to have a certain density to make this work? Or can it work in places like Dallas or St. Louis, where it's much more suburban? Is there a rule of thumb?
The more density, the better. But having said that, you also have universities embracing bike sharing. You have less densities like Portland launching bike sharing, and Houston right there in Texas. So it's across the board. And I think as cycling becomes more mainstream, you're going to see it roll out in very different environments.
We've been talking with Gabe Klein. He is the commissioner of the Chicago Department of Transportation. Gabe, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
When Cherie Booker was 15 years old, she took on a most unusual job for a teenager. She went to work in a Baltimore funeral home. She has written about her time working that job in the book 9 Years Under. The result is a witty, irreverent coming-of-age memoir unlike any other. Cherie Booker, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Early in the book, you write about your Aunt Mary, who I guess had been very important to you, and she became ill, and you write on page 2, after weeks of hospice care and enough meds to tranquilize an army, Aunt Mary slipped through our fingers like $20,000 on a gambler's bad day. No little girl wants to stand by and witness her hero surrender. I wish someone had told me back then that hospice care was the beginning of the end. Then I wouldn't have blamed myself for not doing enough. I wouldn't have felt ignored by God. Was Aunt Mary an inspiration for this book?
She certainly was. My Aunt Mary she was like a grandmother to me. She is the reason I am spoiled to this day. She was always there. She was my father's great aunt, and she was my great great aunt. And she lived with us from the time I was born until she passed away when I was 15 years old. She was my everything.
Her death led you to Wiley's funeral home.
Absolutely. If my Aunt Mary had not passed away, there is no way I would have ended up working in a funeral home. But after Aunt Mary died, I felt like I needed closure. And so while most people run away from death, I ran towards it. I wanted answers. I wanted to make sure that she was in good hands. So I found a way into the funeral home. And it was only supposed to be a summer, and it ended up being 9 years.
And you take us inside that world. And in a way, it was the beginning of your education. Talk to me a little bit about your neighborhood. And your parents, your father was a police officer, mm-hmm. your mother was a school principal. They kept mm-hmm. you pretty protected from the Baltimore neighborhood that was all around you.
Yes. Growing up, I was kind of like a bookworm. And so I was pretty naive and green to certain things, whereas the funeral home was in a totally different neighborhood. In West Baltimore, things that I had never seen growing up, actually.
One of the things I learned from your book is that working at a funeral home is kind of like being on stage, that death lends each day a certain gravitas. Mm-hmm. Was each showing a little bit like a performance piece for you?
I don't know if I would call it a performance piece, but I dealt with grieving families. So I had to be in a different frame of mind to be able to deal with those families who were grieving and a lot of emotions. But the rule was that I wasn't allowed to cry or be emotional, regardless of what I saw on a day-to-day basis. So if it was a baby, if it was a homicide, if there was someone who died naturally, a cute little old lady, I wasn't allowed to cry. One of the things I will say that I at first, when I first started working there, I would cry every time I saw someone in there. As soon as I saw someone else cry, I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe it. Why? And then my boss just came to me one day and he's like, no, you cannot do this. Look at the wall, look at the floor, do something, but you cannot cry in my funeral home. It gave me tougher skin and it made me take my job a lot more seriously.
Albert P. Wiley is a important, if not the most important character in the mm-hmm. book, and I think someone who was important to you.
Absolutely.
Early on, you described him as a hustler. What was it about Wiley that made him such a good funeral home director?
He treated every case like it was his own loved one, and that's what he taught us to do. He had a reputation, and people admired him, and they looked up to him. Because he's that person that when you drive through the neighborhood and you wave your hand up, he's going to holler back at you, hey, how you doing? And, you know, he's that familiar face. Not to mention that he had great swagger and a great personality. He had a great, he drove a Cadillac, and, you know, he's just there. He's visible.
He had a reputation.
Yeah.
A good one. As the years go by, you begin to learn about just how rough things are out there in the poor black community that surrounds Wiley Funeral Home. Mm-hmm. And it moves you to start writing poetry, and you wrote a poem called Endangered Black Man. I wonder mm-hmm. if you would read that poem to us.
Confined to the streets, oppressed, you will never be free. Free from your own bondage, incarcerated not only by physical means, but black man, you are mentally bound to your cage and you're still not enraged. You just don't get it. Endangered black man, you have destroyed me, the voice of the black tomorrow. And now all our people see is sorrow. And no cries of empathy do we ever hear. Never have they shed a tear, but because of you, I live in fear. endangered black man.
There's a lot of emotion in that poem. Anger and sorrow and fear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, we did see cases of retaliation, and we actually had a shootout at the funeral home one day when I was there. A young man was on view, and all of a sudden you just heard all of this chaos, and people were running up the stairs and just banging. And come to find out, there was a drive-by right outside of the funeral home. Someone was trying to shoot this young man's brother.
Let's talk about the embalming room in the basement. You talk about it at first like it's Frankenstein's laboratory, and you're terrified to set foot down there. But over time, you grow into the embalming room yourself. Tell us that story.
Okay, so here was the deal. I started working there when I was 15. My parents really didn't mind, but the one rule that my father set was, whatever you do, do not go in the basement where they do the embalming. But one day, Mr. Wiley called me down in the basement, and I was terrified. I crept down the steps. I'm like, oh my God, heart is beating, racing. I'm starting to feel nauseous. I don't know what I'm going to see. And then he asked me to come in the next room and wipe down a casket. And Mr. Wiley is in that room embalming. And I'm like, oh my God, what have I walked into? Once I realized I could stomach it, I became more curious. And so I just walked over and started asking him a lot of questions. And he basically walked me through the process from where he was. And in that particular day, it was actually a suicide case of a young male. And I will never forget that day because he had inscribed his suicide letter on his arm and it said, I want Peanut to cut my hair and I want my eyes open. And I just will never, ever forget those words for the rest of my life.
But Peanut did not cut his hair and his eyes were not left open, were they?
No,
which speaks to another issue, which is, you know, despite the wishes of the dead, once they are dead, the wishes of the living often take precedence.
I always say, you know, death is not about the person who passed away. It's always about the person who's still left here.
You're now a writer and a teacher, but it's always good to have a trade. Do you think you're done with the funeral home business, or might you go back?
My ultimate goal is to own my own funeral home one day. I would like to get back in the business. I enjoyed servicing families and being there to be their support system. I do not want to embalm every day, but I know the business. It's something that I know very well, and I would definitely like to get back in it.
And so would you recommend to your young daughter at age 15, you know, you should work in a funeral home?
Absolutely not. Now, if I do go into the funeral business, then it will certainly be a family business, so she'll be around it. But if not, then no, I wouldn't recommend it to my daughter.
How come, giving all that you learned and what a wonderful experience it turned out to be for you, why not? Shouldn't every American spend some time working at a funeral home?
You know, I was ready to face death at that point in my life, and I can't say that the next American or the next person would be able to handle something as great as that and the responsibility that it has.
Cherie Booker is the author of 9 Years Under, a coming-of-age memoir of her time working in a Baltimore funeral home. Cherie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Darius Rucker, formerly known as Hootie of the band Hootie and the Blowfish, is on his own these days, making waves in the world of country music.
Church bells ringing on our wedding day. Climbed in that limo and rode away. Guess you'll always hear some people say.
His third album was just released last week. It's called True Believers.
We are one heartbeat in the darkness. We are one lasting answered prayer.
Darius Rucker's on tour now, and he joins us from Simpsonville, South Carolina. Darius Rucker, welcome to the show.
Hey, Wade, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great. True Believers is your third country music album, and it's also the name of the title track. Is a inspiring song, I would say. This is your third country album. You know, how would you rate it compared to the other two?
I think it's the best record I've ever made.
You're more pleased.
Yeah, I mean, I love the other two records, but this record I was head over heels for. I just thought we had really hit it out of the park. We had done exactly what I wanted to do, what I needed to do for my career, and I was just really excited about it.
You know, the track that really impressed me was the next track called Miss You, which is sung from the perspective of a husband who is in bed with his wife and she's gone to sleep.
Laid down in this big old bed and you turned on the TV. Fell asleep without a good night kiss.
And he remembers a time when they would never go to sleep without first kissing each other and hugging each other. But those days are over, and he regrets it.
Oh, yeah, that song. I think everybody who's been in a relationship for a long time can relate to that song. Well, I've had people already come up to me and go, man, you really made me and my wife think about our relationship. And I was like, that's what I wanted to do.
How did we get here? Well, you can be right there. And miss you.
You know, I know this is a question everyone asks you about, which is crossing over from pop to country. And is this a return to your roots? I mean, what was the motivation behind this? Were you coming home?
Yeah, it was country music. You know, I've been saying I was going to make a country record since 1989, saying it for so long, and it was just time to do it. So it's definitely a comeback to the South, you know, come back to where I was born and raised.
Was race ever an issue?
I never thought about it, you know. It's something I never really thought about until I started having hits, like when Don't Think I Don't Think About It started to become a hit and people started talking about, you know, being the first African-American in 25 years to have a hit on the charts. I was shocked. It's not an issue for me. I just want to play, you know, the music I want to play.
Well, this album may be country, but as I listen to it, it's kind of Darius Rucker country. I mean, you're rocking out here pretty good.
Yeah, you know, that's the one thing that we realized, no matter what we did, it was going to sound like Darius Rucker. I like to, you know, give people something to dance to, something to turn it up loud and listen to. And so that's what we try to do with every record. I'm glad I'm not trying to be anything but myself, you know. And so I'm playing the Darius Rucker brand of country, and people are accepting it.
You have a version of a song by Old Crow Medicine Show that's taking off right now. It's called A Wagon Wheel, and it's at the top of the country Billboard chart. So let's hear a bit of it.
Heading down south to the land of the pines, I'm thumbing my way into North Carolina. Staring up the road and pray to God I see headlights. I made it down the coast in 17 hours, picking me a bouquet of dogwood flowers. And I'm hoping for Riley, I can see my baby tonight. So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock me, mama, any way you feel. Hey, mama, rock me.
What was it about this song that inspired you to cover it?
It's such a great tune, and I never even think about cutting that song until I heard it one day at my oldest daughter's high school talent show, and the faculty band got up and played it. They did such a great country version of it that just blew me away. I was like, wow, I never even thought of that song as a country song, but it's a great country song.
I'm running from the cold up in New England. I was born to be a fiddler in an old-time string band. My baby plays the guitar, I pick a banjo now. Country winners keep a getting me down. Lost my money playing poker, so I had to leave town. But I ain't a turning back to living that old life no more.
So I wanted to cut it, and then I've got Lady Antebellum to sing on it, and that took it to a whole new level. And it just seemed to be the perfect thing for me to do.
This album has a range of styles within the country genre. Was that your intention to begin with, or is that simply something you ended up with at the end of the process?
I think, you know, when we're making records, the most important thing to me is always the songs. I don't really think about the styles. I just want to have a lot of great songs that you can put out. And then we were lucky with this record that the songs that came to the floated to the top also had different styles to them. And so it was, once we finished, I was really proud of how many different styles of country music, and that's always a good thing to me.
And at the beginning of one song, you have a little boogie-woogie piano, I think.
Oh yeah, Take Me Home. That's really cool to have. Just that's a one another style of music that I love, and it's really cool to have that on my record. When we started cutting that song, and I heard the big piano that Gordon Moat was playing, I was like, man, that's awesome.
I wanted more.
Help me too.
I wanna hear a southern drawl and taste every word that lingers. I need a Sunday morning song by a just got baptized singer. I've been away too long. Somebody take me home.
The other song that I really like is Radio, which is a roll down your windows, turn the radio up loud, and drive 20 miles an hour too fast and let her rip.
It is one of those big summer songs where you just turn up turn it up, put the windows down to get your friends in the car and drive and just sing along. I love that tune.
And I thought maybe I heard an echo of Wall of Voodoo's song, Mexican Radio.
That's exactly what we were going for when we did that. And I'm on a Mexican radio.
You nailed it, because the way they say radio and the way you say radio is exactly the same.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was going for.
I hear rumors of a Hootie and the Blowfish reunion next year. You want to give us a scoop?
You know, we're talking about it. We're talking about doing some shows.
Now, Darius, you know, this is National Public Radio, so this is a good place to break news if you'd like to.
Oh, I got nothing to break. We're still just talking about it, man. I mean, we haven't even, I don't think the four of us have even gotten together. We've just been sending emails that, we might want to do something next year, but no one's got anything written in stone.
Darius Rucker, thanks so much for coming on the show, and good luck.
Thank you, Wade. Good talking to you.
You got the keys, girl. I'm just a rider. Gas it up and get us out of here. Put the pedal down. I want to fly, girl. Crank it up and get another gear up. Let's go to Vegas and California or Carolina where the southern breeze blows.
For the week ending June 2nd, 2013, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Becky Sullivan, Liz Baker, Amy Held, Lily Percy, Reem McCrace, and Connor Donovan. Our intern is Rachel Rude. The technical director is Daniel Shukin. Muthoni Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Wade Goodwin. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.
You can pick the place, I don't care.